From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. The 4th of July weekend is underway, and most of us will be kicking back to enjoy it. But around the country, a very few people will be spending this weekend thinking about the biggest decision of their professional lives, running for the Democratic nomination for president. Think about it. In America, anyone can grow up to be president. But the reality is that no more than a dozen folks, almost all men, can realistically think about actually running for that office. Vermont Governor Howard Dean is not, at first glance, one of them, but he has worked vigorously in recent months to put himself in that group. When the governor of Vermont flies to Iowa on a regular basis, you know he's serious. But who is Howard Dean? What does he stand for? On Point listeners, we're talking with Vermont Governor Howard Dean in this hour. What prospects would candidate Dean realistically have against incumbent George W. Bush, even if he could beat the Gores and Edwards of the Democratic Party? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Vermont is Governor Howard Dean. Good evening, Governor.
How are you?
Fine. And in the studio with me, our own On Point news analyst is Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hey, Jack. We're going to come to you in a second, Jack, but first let me ask you, Governor Dean, who are you?
Well, I'm a 53-year-old doctor who is the longest-serving Democratic governor in the country, former chair of the National Governors, the Democratic Governors, and been doing the recruiting of Democratic gubernatorial candidates around the country for the last 5 years. We've got a great record in Vermont, which I'm sure we'll get into, mostly on health care and fiscal responsibility. And I'm interested in running for president because I think the country's fundamentally going in the wrong economic direction. And I think that we ought to, as a physician, that we ought to have health care for every American.
Fiscally, would you describe yourself as a conservative?
Yes. I think the single biggest mistake that the president has made since he's been in office is the tax cuts. The tax cuts have turned a significant budget surplus into a huge deficit. It's affecting our ability to deliver services to people, and it's undermining our economy, as it did in the 1980s, when President Reagan put in huge tax cuts without budget discipline and creating the kind of deficits that will ultimately drive private capital out of the market and raise interest rates.
Well, describe a bit of a, what's been your approach to the finances, the public finances in Vermont, mm-hmm. since you came into office actually on the death of your predecessor? I mean, you weren't elected initially to the office.
I became governor under very difficult circumstances. We had the largest deficit in the history of the state. We had the highest marginal income tax in the history of the state. And I had to reduce both taxes and the deficits, which were enormous. We had the worst bond rating in New England, and on it goes. What we did was slowly and painstakingly cut the budget, cut the taxes, and work towards an improvement of our fiscal situation. And today, we managed to get ourselves in a position where we have the highest bond rating in New England. We have a substantial rainy day account, which is allowing us to get through the difficult problems that we've had, that every state's had. And we've reduced our per capita debt by 23% in the last 5 years, which I dare say no other governor of either party can talk about. So I really am a fiscal conservative. We have cut taxes twice. But what we've not done is those enormous tax cuts, which were done principally for political reasons, because when you look at a budget, you've got to look at tax cuts and spending in the same way. They both unbalance budgets if you do too much of them.
When you cut taxes, but did you cut government programs as well? We're trying to figure out how a Democrat can roll things back and be so conservative fiscally and still touch base with his Democratic constituencies.
Here's what we did. We did do some tax cuts. We tried to balance the tax cuts. One of the biggest flaws in the president's tax cut is they are not stimulatory to the economy because most middle-class people have no idea they got a tax cut. They got those big checks, the $600 checks if they're married, and then they realized in April that they had to add them back into their tax return and pay taxes on them. So most middle-class and working-class people in this country did not get a tax cut. The tax cut went predominantly to the top 2% of people. Those folks didn't run out and spend them. In fact, they lost them because those are the same folks that were in the stock market, and in some cases giving folks like us a screwing in the stock market. And that
you say folks like us.
Pardon?
Folks like us. How do you have nothing in the stock market?
Sure. sure. I mean, I didn't lose any money at Enron, but my stocks have all gone down, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that people have lost confidence in corporations, and the folks that at the top of those corporations were the big beneficiaries of the tax cut. Certainly not people even making $100,000 a year, let alone $75,000 or $50,000 or $25,000. What we did is a totally different approach. First, we started to cut programs. Secondly, we cut taxes. Thirdly, we didn't try to do the whole thing at once. We never submitted a budget in 11 years that I've been governor where the budget increase was greater than the rate of inflation. Greater than the rate of the economic growth. At first, we didn't submit one greater than the rate of inflation. Then, as inflation was very moderate and we kept taking in huge amounts of money, we began to raise the budget a little bit with using the state's economic growth rate as the indicator. That left us an enormous amount of money. That money we put into paying off the debt, doing capital projects that were one-shot expenditures so they would not appear in the budget as an ongoing expenditure, and then we'd have to sustain them when times got bad. So we didn't have a huge budget overhang that had to be sustained of all new programs.
Governor, I'm going to interrupt you because I just want to go back to something you said a minute ago. You said you cut programs. What programs did you cut?
We've just gotten through one round of cuttings. We cut back on medical programs. We've not taken anybody off the rolls because one of my goals for the country is health care for everybody. But we have required people to share more of the medical costs that they pay for out of their own pocket. That's just one example.
Any others? Education cuts?
Think of some, but I don't have them right at the top of my head. This was 10 or 15 years, 10 or 12 years ago that we made all these cuts.
Right.
But at the same time, we zero balanced a bunch of items, which means we built their budgets from the beginning. And while we were cutting the budget and while we were cutting taxes, we also had enough money left over for health insurance for every child in the state, which we did over a 4 or 5 year period, and home visits to 91% of all of our children within 2 weeks of their birth, which has resulted in a huge drop in child abuse. So you can do socially good things for the traditional Democratic constituency, but you can't do it all at once. You have to do it piece by piece and bit by bit. And then you hang on to those gains because you haven't raised the spending level so fast during the good times, and therefore it needn't come down so much during the bad times.
Jack Beatty with me in the studio. Our senior news analyst has been furiously taking notes, trying to keep pace with you. Jack?
Hello, Governor Dean.
Hi there.
I live in Hanover, so I'm often in Vermont, and I look with envy on your state. And I should say that you've had to hone your fiscal conservatism against the most fiscally conservative state in the union. You've been in a competitive situation vis-a-vis the no-tax New Hampshire economy.
Yeah, but the no-tax New Hampshire economy, Republicans are not fiscally conservative, and that legislature is a Republican legislature. They're about $200 million in the hole, as I understand it now. Mm-hmm. We are not, because we have this big rainy day fund. And the difference is that Republicans embrace the notion of borrow and spend. This is my big problem with President Bush with his budget. We go back to the borrow and spend and borrow and spend politics that have been shown by many Republicans, but particularly this president, as well as President Reagan, and it leads to enormous deficits. I think it's well known that President Reagan and the first President Bush quadrupled the national debt in their tenure, and this President Bush is well on the way to increasing it some more. You don't have to do that. It's not necessary to do it, and it's no better than tax and spend liberal Democrats. In fact, it's worse because at least the liberal Democrats are balancing the budget. The Republicans don't balance budgets. They can't pay their bills, and it's time that we had it. I believe the party of fiscal responsibility, which is the Democrats, not the Republicans, in charge of the White House.
That's, of course, an achievement that Bill Clinton brought about, isn't it?
The only three balanced budgets since 1968 in the United States were under Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Governor, you want to make health care for everyone one of your goals. In the Clinton Care episode, one of the things that happened was that the whole issue arose in a Senate race, first in Pennsylvania,
yes, Harris Wofford.
And it was a recession, 1991, and people who had insurance were worried about keeping their insurance.
That's right. That's what's driving them.
And therefore, you could talk to them about people who didn't have insurance at all. But what happened when, by the time the program got around to being proposed in 1993, was that the lobbies were able to create distance between the insured and the uninsured.
Right.
And they basically were saying to the insured, hey, why do you want to mess with your coverage to give some poor guy coverage?
And there's much to be learned from that. And my whole model of how to bring this to the United States is fundamentally structured to deal with just what we learned during the 1993 debacle. The Democrats have had health care for all Americans in their platform since 1948 when Harry Truman ran for re-election. Now, we have basically failed to deliver that for a variety of reasons, and I think that we can overcome those. Here are the problems. There are still 40-odd million Americans who are uninsured. Who are those people? They are principally not unemployed people, although those are some. Most of them work. They work for small businesses. They work for themselves. They work for companies, large companies, that do not provide benefits because they work part-time. Now, what I want to do is take the Vermont program, which we essentially insure every child, or every child is eligible, or almost every child, 99%, is either insured or eligible in Vermont. So we have universal health insurance for everybody under the age of 18 years old. Secondly, what I'd like to do is expand that to 22. Let it be a state program, have there be a federal match, essentially the Medicaid program as we have now. If you bring that up to 300% of poverty, which we have, everybody under 22 has insurance.
Okay, Governor, I'm going to stop you right there and just ask you to explain 300% of poverty. That's the kind of number that in this debate confuses ordinary listeners and ordinary voters.
Sure.
What do you mean by that?
In our state today, if you and a family of four make $52,000 a year, Your children are guaranteed health insurance. You have to pay for something if you're up the upper end of that. You have to pay $50 a month to insure every child in your family under 18. That's what 300% of poverty is. That gives us 96% of all our children with health insurance, and 4% who don't have it. Of those, 3 of those percent are eligible for the program. They're just not signed up for whatever reason.
Okay. And you want to expand this in your state to the age of 22?
No, I wanted to expand this in the country. To the age of 22.
Right.
I'll require the states to do it, but before they start shouting unfunded mandate, the federal government will take back responsibility for another technical, mind-boggling policy wonk term, the dual eligibles. That means if you're over 65 in this country and Medicare is not enough and you're too poor to pay any of the co-payments, the state will step in and help you through Medicaid. That's a very fast-growing item in states' budgets. I would have the federal government take that back in return for the states guaranteeing coverage to everybody up to the age of 22. The states will win on that fiscally, and, of course, they'll also get a very expensive and fast-growing bill transferred to the federal government.
Now, in this conversation, one of the interesting things is finding a way to explain this. You speak about taking this outside of Vermont and taking it nationally, presumably when...
I think it's very easy to understand. Let me do the shorthand without getting into the policy, if that's what you want. Okay, everybody under 22 is guaranteed coverage through the state. They'll have to pay something for it. Everybody over 65 gets Medicare plus a prescription benefit. Everybody understands that. And here's the really, I think, the best part of this system. Between 22 and 65, you don't change the system, except for one detail. In other words, you get your insurance just like you do today through your employer, except for those people who don't have insurance will have a subsidy so they can buy insurance when they work for small businesses, when they work for big corporations on a part-time basis, or when they work for themselves. Now, everybody can understand that. When I gave a speech about this in Minnesota a few months ago, a 75-year-old lady comes up afterwards and says, Governor, my husband passed away a few years ago. He worked for Owens Corning, and I have great benefits. Don't you take my health insurance away. That was what was left over from the Harry and Louise campaign. I get to say to her, your health insurance isn't going to change at all. Don't worry. And I say to Americans, the 80 to 100 million who have health insurance through their employment, don't worry. For you, the system will not change. You'll still get your health insurance. You have to deal with the expense problem, but that's a separate problem.
Governor, we're coming up to the break. That's what the music means.
All right.
We're going to come back to you Very shortly, listeners, we are talking with Vermont Governor Howard Dean, prospective Democratic candidate for president in the year 2004. It's time to start thinking about these things, people. Call in, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Join in the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Vermont Governor Howard Dean, prospective Democratic candidate for president, a man who has straightened out the books in his state of Vermont and along the way has managed to do something which seems to be almost a holy grail of American public policy, which is extend some kind of universal health care to a significant section of the population, which is children. His plan, and as we were hearing just before the break, he's got a plan to get everybody under the age of 22 insured, everybody over the age of 65 insured, and everybody in the middle would get, if they don't have their own, some kind of subsidy. Am I right, Governor? Is that a good summary?
That's a great summary, and that's, it's easy to understand. You don't make the fundamental mistake that was made, that we all made in 1993, by radically restructuring the whole system. There are many who believe the whole system should be radically changed, but that does not include the Congress, and it will not include the Congress, and it certainly will not include all the interest groups that paid for those Harry and Louise ads. Mm-hmm. So what this, the part of this plan, the advantage of this plan, is that you only alienate a couple of interest groups in Congress, not all of them, which the Clinton plan did, and that you can easily explain it to the American people. The weakness of the plan is it will not cover 100%. But if we get to 96%, that's about where the Germans are, and they have a plan that's considered to be universal health care. We are the only industrialized country in the world without universal health care. There's no reason for that.
Jack Beattie.
What about the – when people talk about this, Governor, it's easy for them to make it sound as if this is an altruistic issue, that the uninsured should be insured. What's the economic argument for universal?
Well, I think that interestingly, the biggest issue that I'm hearing in places like Iowa and Minnesota and Wyoming is fear of the economic climate. American corporations have lost the respect of the American people. People are really worried. They're not, I mean, they're angry, but they're not so populist. They're much smarter than that. They don't want to drive the corporations out of America. They know that corporations bring big jobs. They just don't trust them anymore. One of the things we need to do from an economic point of view is start to figure out how to help small businesses and not aim all our tax policy at large businesses. We need to do that at the state level as well as the national level. Health insurance that's government subsidized is a big benefit to small businesses. We have a lot of small businesses in our state that put their kids on our program with their families making less than $52,000 a year, and then the small businesses only have to pay for health insurance for the employee and the spouse. So there's a savings right there. Economically, we actually talk to people about the fact that we will take care of people's kids in terms of health insurance. I think it's a good thing economically for the country. It will allow us to compete in some ways that we can't compete in now. And the beauty of it all is there's enough money to do this and to restore the payments to Social Security and to do a pharmaceutical benefit for Medicare if we only will roll back those tax cuts that really only benefited the top 2% who then ran those corporations that turned on us and took away people's pensions and stole money and so forth and so on. Those tax cuts were targeted just the very wrong people from an economic point of view and a moral point of view. We get rid of the tax cuts. We go back to the same tax structure we had when President Clinton was in the White House. The country was a lot better off economically then, and we are still able to do some of these insurance things. We cannot have a sweeping, huge program. I'm not promising everybody everything. There will be co-payments. This plan that people will be able to buy into will not be the Cadillac plan that you get if you work for General Electric or IBM, but it will be a plan, mm-hmm. and people will be able to afford it.
Let's move on to some other policies, Governor. I mean, education, President Bush has a bill before the Congress. Teddy Kennedy has his own initiative. Where do you stand in terms of the national plans that are out there, and what have you done in Vermont that you could bring to a national stage?
Well, the president's, I think most people are not going to find this out till after the election. The president's education bill was the second largest unfunded mandate ever passed by Congress. When they find out what it's going to cost local property taxpayers, I think there's going to be a huge revision in Congress. Basically, they have mandated that they will define who is which school in your state is a failing school, and you will do a number of very expensive things to respond, and you have no choice about what you do. You have to do certain things, and most of that gets picked up by the property taxpayers. The American people have not figured that out yet, but the school boards are starting to figure it out, and the superintendents, and when the property tax comes around a year from now to pay for all those changes, it's going to be pretty extraordinary. I mean, this bill is the largest federal power grab of any bill that I can think of in a long time. For example, I'll give you three little things.
Let me just quickly introduce the thing that I'm always amazed by is how when Republicans, governors, get to the White House, having stood outside, the federal government centralizes everything, the states should be running stuff, they always centralize more than when Democratic governors seem to get to the White House. Why is that?
I don't know. I think it's because to them the means justifies the ends, or the ends justify the means, mm-hmm. rather. They're perfectly happy to do whatever it... I mean, you know, when I was the leader of the NGA, it was during when the Democrats took power and then the transition. We used to fight terribly with the Democratic leadership in the House because they were trying to centralize things. After the Republicans took over, we just realized that all we'd done is a substitute conservative micromanagement for liberal micromanagement.
Did you work closely with George Bush there in the governor's conference when he was governor of Texas?
No, we have a good working relationship. I mean, we had a good working relationship. He's certainly not a bad person or anything of that sort, but I just think his policies are very bad for the country.
800-422...
Go ahead. Out the number, and we'll talk a little more about education.
you have no idea how many people want to talk to you on the phone line. So let me say the magic words, numbers. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mike is on the line.
Hello?
Hello. Yo,
hello.
Hi, Governor. My question for you is, with your lower name recognition currently than Vice President Gore or Speaker Gephardt, let's say, and... a fairly liberal message when it comes to certain social issues. What is your sort of plan for bringing your message to the base of the Democratic Party throughout the country?
Well, I'm not so sure balancing the budget. I don't think balancing the budget is a particularly liberal issue, but certainly health care is the traditional liberal issue. I think most people are very worried about the economy. I think they're going to want to try something different. The biggest advantage I have over the other folks that are running is that I'm a governor. And people who work in Washington talk differently than people who, you know, they're not dumber or not as good people or anything like that. They're good people. But there's a penalty in Washington for saying what you think. That's what governors get paid to do. Every day I have to make decisions where I have to disappoint somebody and I have to please somebody. And then I have to explain to the people who I disappointed why I did what I did. That's what the American people want. They want some answers that are straightforward. And what people in Washington get paid to do is to offend as few people as possible. Well, you can't run America and offend as few people as possible. Sometimes you have to stand up for principles, and that's basically what this candidacy is going to be about.
But the other part of Mike's question, Governor, was the money factor.
I've got to raise money. I won't have as much as any of the people from Washington. Fortunately, we're starting off with three states where retail politics is very important. You know, John McCain did very well without money. Gary Hart did very well without money. Dick Gephardt did well in 88 without money. There's no guarantee that I can make this work, but I think the American people are going to want to hear this message. I was the first Democrat to call for rescinding the tax cuts. Senator Lieberman has since joined me. I was actually the first governor in the country, Republican or Democrat, speaking of liberal versus conservative, to do welfare reform. We got our waivers 2 weeks before Wisconsin did, and it required people to work for welfare. Our program was a lot different than what Gingrich and his folks ultimately passed, but it's been incredibly successful. So I would say that I was more practical than liberal, but as we go through this discussion, we're going to find out that that there are some conservative sides. For example, I have an A from the National Rifle Association. I think it's going to be hard to pin me as a conservative versus a liberal, but I think that A from the National Rifle Association is going to help a lot in places like South Carolina and Tennessee, where Democrats are sick of losing because of the national gun issue.
But in those very same towns, Governor, you know that you're going to get hammered on arguably the policy that brought you the most national notice, which is your willingness to endorse the judicial decision for gay civil unions in Vermont.
Right. I think everybody ought to have the same civil rights in America, and I think most Americans are willing to listen to that, and September 11th is one of the reasons. I haven't had one question, other than from a reporter or from a member of the gay and lesbian community, about civil unions since since September 11th. Why? Because every kind of American and a lot of people who weren't American died in those buildings. You know, African Americans and whites and Hispanics and Jews and Catholics and Muslims and people from all different kinds of nations, and yes, gay people and straight people as well. And I think September 11th proved a lot of things, and one of the things that it proved was very good about this country is that we're basically one family. A lot of people recognize that, realize that. I think civil rights for all Americans has been something that's been a bedrock of the American character for the last 50 years. I think people are willing to stand up and say, yep, we think that everybody ought to have the same rights and be treated the same.
Jack, it's always good to hear ideals from someone who's standing for president. Do you think those ideals can translate to the places where the NRA would not look at a Democratic candidate twice?
Well, it would sure cross-pressure that voter, wouldn't it?
Well, let me tell you why this is helpful. I mean, the reason I have an A from the NRA is we don't have gun laws in Vermont. The reason we don't have gun laws in Vermont is because we have the lowest homicide rate in the United States. We had 5 homicides the whole year, 1 year when I was governor. Our average is about 18. So gun control wouldn't do any good here. Now, so I've never supported it. Now, I understand that some people in New York or Boston or Los Angeles want gun control, and my attitude is let them have it. That's why I do really truly believe that the states ought to have some power to run their own affairs. What's good for New York is not always good for Wyoming and Alabama and Vermont, and I think we need to recognize that you've got to do things differently in different states. Now, I'll tell you where this is helpful. We lose about 35% to 40% of union membership every year in the Democratic Party. Union members ought to be voting Democratic 100% of the time because on economic issues, we are really where working people are, and they understand that. But we lose them on issues like gun control. Bill Clinton won Montana by 4%. Al Gore lost Montana by 26%. Al Gore lost Tennessee by 12%. When I went down and talked to activists in Tennessee, they didn't like my position on gun control, but they were delighted to see me because they don't want to anymore deal with the national issue of gun control and have the Democrats brought down by that issue. It is an issue that ought to be solved at the state level, not the national level. And if I take that position, I don't have to antagonize voters who would normally be Democratic voters on economic issues.
But we talked about these voters being cross-pressured, Governor. On the one hand, yeah, he's against gun control. On the other hand, he's for civil unions, which is, at least in terms of social policy, ahead of where the polls say most Americans are. So what
I
do
don't
you
agree with that.
Okay.
If you ask people, should we have gay marriage, they're going to say no.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't have gay marriage. What we have is civil rights mm-hmm. for everybody. Civil unions basically says, look, I'm a married person, right? If my wife gets sick, I get to visit her in the hospital, and I get to have some say in her care if something terrible happens. If I die, she gets the house without going through probate, the insurance, you know, so forth and so on. Well, we woke up on September 11th, and there were a lot of people who died, and that was a difficult issue. But for gay people who were couples who died in those buildings, that meant they didn't have any of the things that I have or that my wife has. Mm-hmm. And it didn't seem to me that those folks ought to have less rights than we do. Mm-hmm. And I think most Americans are going to see the wisdom of that, not all of them for sure. I think there's a lot of homophobia and fear about gay people in this country. But the truth is that gay people are 95% just like the rest of us. They want the best education. They want the best jobs. They believe in their country. And they want to do what's right for their families. And that just unites them, I think, with everybody else in America.
800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Ellen is on the line.
Hi. My question is, let me begin with a statement. The Bush administration is probably remarkable for having placed the U.S. in a position of belligerency vis-a-vis the rest of the world. He has refused to sign the Kyoto Treaty. He has claimed that Americans of all people in the world should be exempt from trial in the world court. I wondered what the governor's position would be in terms of the United States' role in the world. Will it continue to be a force for domination and confrontation in this regard, or would he see its role as being, having to be, in the wake of 9/11, I should add, more cooperative?
Ellen, I think we have the gist of your question, and because the segment's going to end, I want the governor to have a crack at that one.
Let me say that I'm in favor of a strong country and a strong defense. I've been incredibly critical of the Bush foreign policy for exactly the reason the caller says. we can accomplish the things we have to accomplish to defend our interests in this world without alienating everybody in the country. I happened to be in South Korea and Japan a few weeks after the president's evil axis speech, and the day actually before he got to that part of the world. the people were very upset. Not only were our people upset, but the locals from Japan and Korea were upset, although the Japanese, of course, were much too polite to say so. But the truth is that we didn't need to do that. We can speak softly and carry a big stick. We can be tough with North Korea. We can build a strong military. But to alienate everybody in the world is crazy. There are about eight things, starting with Kyoto and working through the World Court and the ABM and START 2, which is going to be modified, and all these different things that the president has simply withdrawn from. We cannot be alien in this world. We can be a dominant superpower. We can defend our interests, but cooperation is absolutely essential, and I think you get more for it.
Let me throw a specific at you, sir. Even as we speak, the UN is in session. They're trying to figure out what to do about the U.S. threat to pull its peacekeepers out of UN missions if American soldiers are not exempted from the jurisdiction of the ICC, the International Criminal Court. How would you, what's your policy decision on that? Should the U.S. be part of the ICC?
That's a very difficult issue, and I think there is a compromise to be had there. The issue of political trials for Americans is of great concern, and there have been times in the—
Do you endorse the International Criminal Court?
Pardon?
Do you endorse the idea of an International Criminal Court?
I endorse the idea of it, but I think we do have to look carefully about whether we get into it. I lean towards supporting things like Kyoto and the ICC. The issue, the president is right to be concerned about this issue. He's right to examine it carefully. He's wrong to pull out the peacekeeping forces. I think there is a compromise to be had there, and I think we should find it.
Ellen, I want to thank you for that call. We're going to have a break shortly, and I know from having spoken to you now for the last 15 minutes that if I open up some small door, we're going to have a hard time rounding it up. Let me just stick with foreign policy for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Ellen was concerned about the belligerency of the Bush administration in its conduct of foreign policy since September 11th. It was fairly somnolent before September 11th. Do you think that tone matters? Is it important for the United States to conduct itself with the kind of wisdom that comes from exceptional power?
I'll give you a perfect example of what is wrong with the president's foreign policy. The president gave a speech in which he said that Yasser Arafat should not be elected by the Palestinians, and therefore, if he were elected, we would not be able to proceed any further towards peace. Here's the problem. I think this show is coming from Boston. Is that right?
That's right.
Let's just suppose that I came to Massachusetts and I said, you should not elect so-and-so as governor. Wouldn't there be a fair amount of resentment that I was interfering in this process? Now, I think the president's right. I think Arafat is not suitable for negotiation with peace. I think he's much more interested in his own power than he is in the Palestinian state. And I think he's misplayed his hand for 50 years. But to publicly say that puts you in a very embarrassing position. I think the likely outcome, frankly, is that the Palestinians will stick a thumb in our eye and they'll reelect him. And then what are we going to do?
What we're going to do, we're going to go for the break right now. We're talking with Vermont Governor Howard Dean. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Vermont Governor Howard Dean, prospective Democratic candidate for the presidential nomination in 2004. And no, 2 years. Am I right, Governor? 2 years is not enough time too soon to be thinking about running for president.
Not for somebody from a small state.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. Rob is on the line.
Yes, hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. Good evening, Governor.
Hi.
I'm calling because I'm interested in education. I know that's going to be a very hot topic in the presidential election. And one of the things I'm concerned about, not just with President Bush's bill, but also with a lot of the rhetoric I've heard, talking about standards, talking about testing, talking about teacher performance, it seems to be focusing a lot on the quality of teachers and testing, but I don't hear much about equality of education in terms of, for example, you know, we're a show coming from the Boston area. For example, Boston is an inner city school district. Just a few miles away, you have very affluent communities where you see huge disparity in what the children are getting. Class sizes ranging from 18 in a town like Belmont or Newton, and 28 in a school in Boston, which is only 5-10 miles away.
Let me try to answer some of those questions by telling you, and I hope briefly, what we've done in Vermont, what I would hope to do in the country. In Vermont, we have a system which equalizes school funding within the state. Now, it's controversial. Obviously, the federal government doesn't have a role in that, so that's what we would not do in the country. We'd have to do something different, and I'm going to tell you what that is in a minute. We establish testing. We want high standards testing. It's not norm-based testing. And what we do is we release the results. Everybody knows which school performs well, which school doesn't perform well, and then we support those schools that don't perform well and bring in their faculty along with the faculty of places that do perform well. We do a lot of work to try to upgrade both teaching and learning. What should have been done instead of this huge unfunded federal mandate, which I frankly do not think is going to help the nation's schools, is what the president should have done is say, okay, here's the test. We would like everybody to take this test, which we are going to, which he's got in his bill, and we're going to publish the standards, and we're going to help with those districts that don't do well. And we're going to put a little money in, and we're going to have some support for improved teaching. And then there can be some sanctions. We have a sanction in our bill. If your school consistently underperforms, the state can take over the school. We have never had to do that, but we could do it. But then the money, there should be some money, which goes into infrastructure in schools that are really at the bottom of the barrel. The federal government is doing nothing about that. President Clinton was going to do something about it. The Republican Congress wouldn't let him pass it. President Bush doesn't think we should be doing that. The biggest problem in our schools today, in many ways, is infrastructure. The other big problem in our school is much harder to do something about, and that is this. We can do all the computers and all the infrastructure and all the teacher training you want, but the single largest indicator of whether kids do well in school or not is what they hear about education at home. And so we have got to start working with parents in a constructive way to bring them into the process of improving schools and make the school boards responsible. And that's one of the reasons for publishing the results of tests. I do not believe the tests ought to be connected to graduation. Some kids are going to be great at art and lousy in math, and what's the point of making it impossible for them to graduate from high school? You ought to have some stakes so that kids will try their best on the test. But we think our situation's worked very well in Vermont. I think we ranked sixth or something in the country on the National Assessment for Educational Progress. But we've got to invest federal money in infrastructure because states that are dependent on property taxes will not fix those inner-city schools in Boston and New York.
Jack Beatty.
Governor, you mentioned the program you have that equalizes funding. It's called Act 60.
Right.
And it is indeed controversial. And, for example, friends of mine in Norwich tell me within a year or two they have to move because Norwich is a so-called gold town, which not only has to pay – well, you explain it, but I think it goes this way – not only has to pay its assessment for the schools, but something over and above that that goes to a poorer town. I think that sounds like a great idea, but it also looks, in the way it's working out in your state, and I think you have to be candid here, like liberal social engineering perhaps gone awry, in that middle-class people in these so-called gold towns, they don't feel very golden.
Well, here's the problem in that particular town. They spend an enormous amount of money. And they don't have full control over it because they're hooked in with Hanover right across the river, which is building a new high school, which has driven up their costs. In our state, under our formula, one penny in the property tax raises exactly the same amount of money per pupil in every town in the state. So that if you are a middle-class person in any state that spends in any town that spends $12,000 or $13,000 a year, then your tax is going to be very high, no matter if it's a rich town or a poor town. For towns that have been used to being able to do much better than that, that's tough for them because, their expenses are now commensurate with the cost. However, there is, for middle-class people, a circuit breaker, which allows them basically, if you make less than $75,000 a year in our state, your property tax depends on your income. You don't pay more than about 2.5% or 3% of your income in property taxes. And if the budget goes way up, the state will make sure you get a check back.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Bill is on the line.
Good evening.
Hi.
Governor, the answer you should have given on the Kyoto Accord And the International War Crimes Tribunal was yes and yes, period. But I'm digressing from the question I was going to ask you. The Democrats have had an awful lot of practice in rolling over and playing dead. I was wondering, when can I expect my party to stand up and fight?
Well, I've done that since Gingrich took over. I was the first. In fact, I think my quote was, I think they must be smoking opium in the Speaker's office. And I agree that maybe the answer should be yes on the International Court in Kyoto, but I'm not going to say that until I know exactly what's in those treaties. I tend towards leaning yes, but I got to know what's in that before I endorse it. I've got a lot to learn about foreign affairs and international treaties until I know exactly what's in that and make sure the Republicans' charges about costing jobs and all that stuff are wrong. I think it'd be foolish to get out on a limb. You'll probably end up hearing me endorse Kyoto, but not until I'm ready to do it and feel comfortable with the fact.
Bill, when you talk about fighting, what kind of fighting are you talking about?
I can't believe how the field has been left to the Republicans. I mean,
which field? The whole field?
The arguments. They define who is and is not patriotic with nearly a whimper from the Democrats. I mean, and the other thing that bothers me to no end, I mean, I'm going back to the presidential election. I cannot believe an intellectual non-entity like Bush lost, won over how do you lose to that type of person? Especially if you are a rogue scholar and actually know what you're talking about. The Democrats blew that election.
Okay, we're looking forward to 2004, but Governor, go ahead and answer Bill.
Let me just be very blunt. Do not underestimate George Bush. One of the reasons we lost is that people from the Northeast have sort of this prejudice against people from the South. I have Tom Wicker, who's a wonderful former columnist for the New York Times, happens to live in Vermont now. He's from North Carolina. We were talking about this one time over dinner, and I said, Tom, don't you think from people from the Northeast have this innate prejudice against Southerners? And he said, you know, Governor, when somebody comes up here from the South, I always tell him to hang on to his accent as long as you can, because you'll always be underestimated. Do not underestimate George Bush. George Bush is not stupid. He's not an intellectual, but that doesn't mean he's stupid. He's a damn good politician. I think his policies are much worse than his father's policies, but his politics is much, much better.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Eric is on the line.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Howard. I was a member of your state, of a resident, and I had to leave. I moved there in 1995, but I found it a hostile business environment.
How so?
I don't buy that. Why did you find it hostile?
Because of all the environmentalism that really prohibits expansion. We manufacture small products in Westfield, Vermont, and the desire to expand was squashed by all the environmental mandates.
Well, you know, without knowing the specifics, I don't know how to respond exactly, but I would disagree. But everybody has their own story. I was in New Hampshire at a Rotary Club, which is not exactly known for liberal politics, and I was giving a speech, and a guy at the end, that was a question period. The guy stands up at the end and says, Governor, the Vermont business climate is obviously great, and the one here in New Hampshire stinks. Can't you tell our people what they can do to make our climate better? And I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll bring you up to all the Rotaries in Vermont and have you say what you just said. Everybody always thinks the situation in their own state is much worse, and everybody has horror stories. I don't know what your story is, and certainly, I'd be actually interested in hearing what it was, because probably some things we could improve. But I really don't think our business climate is particularly bad. There's been plenty of surveys that say it's bad. There's been plenty of surveys that say it's terrific. And I think it's probably not a whole lot different than a lot of other places. Although I will say that in some of the southern states, they do pay less attention to environmental laws. And I think probably they are perhaps a better business climate. Because of that, Alabama wrote a check for $300 million to Mercedes to bring a factory in there. That's clearly not the kind of thing we would do in Vermont. And from that point of view, you may be right.
We're coming to the end of the hour, Governor, and I'd just like to ask you, just practically, you're running for president, and I'm wondering if you've got far enough along to have the usual coterie of advisors yet.
We have some. I'm starting to be briefed on. Well, I've been in 50 countries in my life, which is probably more than the president will have been by November of 2004. And so I'm fairly comfortable and able to learn foreign policy pretty quickly, including having lived abroad for a year. Defense is more complicated. I'm starting to do the necessary work that I have to do in defense. So we have all kinds of advisors, and I'm acquiring more as we go along.
Do Do you have a media guy? Do you have a pollster?
I have a media guy, and we don't need a pollster for at least another year, so I have a pollster.
So in this wonderful moment, we can hear you frank and unframed by what the focus groups are telling you.
You're going to hear that anyway. One of my trademarks is that I say what I think, and I can guarantee you that I'll get into trouble doing that before this thing is over. Probably, you know, possibly a huge, enormous gaffe. Hopefully not. But, you know, don't forget, I've run for statewide election for governor five times, and before that, three times as lieutenant governor. So I have a fair amount of experience in campaigns, albeit in a smaller state. I've run the state for 11 years. I've made mistakes. But my approach is to be very direct, to say what I think, mm-hmm. To disagree with people politely and respectfully if I can. But I have a very strong view of what this country should look like, mm-hmm. and it's certainly not the direction that we're headed in right today.
Governor, I think David Broder in a recent column was following you around, and he quoted someone as asking you, what do you think about Bush's handling of the war? And you said, I think he's done a good job on the war. And your interlocutor said, are you sure? And the balance of the column is about a kind of emerging disquiet among Democratic voters about the way the president is handling the war. And yet you and all the Democratic candidates want no light between you and Mr. Bush at all.
I'm very willing to be critical of the president's foreign policy, and I certainly have some suggestions to make about the Homeland Security bill that I would do differently. I think to criticize the handling of the war is a mistake, and I don't think it's justified. The truth is that we have crippled al-Qaeda. They're still very dangerous, but we've driven them out of their place of residence, and we are hopefully going to do the right thing in terms of nation building, which President Bush has spoken out against, but I think it's, again, I disagree with him, to make sure that we can build a strong middle class in which women can participate in the society in Afghanistan, which would then assure that we would not have future problems there. But I think, you know, just because I'm running against the president doesn't mean I have to disagree with him in every single area, and I simply don't disagree with him in the prosecution of the war.
Does that include Iraq and a possible attack on Iraq?
Here's the problem with bombing Iraq. Look, everybody agrees that if Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, we can't allow that to continue. What is the game plan afterwards? If you think Afghanistan has problems with any kind of government infrastructure, there is no one that can run Iraq and no one who can even look to run Iraq. So if we bomb Iraq and drive Saddam Hussein from power, we have to first have a plan so that we don't end up with American troops in Iraq for the next 10 years running the place, because I think that's an untenable and an impossible situation. I think it will lead to more terrorism at home. So what makes me nervous about the president's talk about Iraq is not that I think it's okay for Saddam Hussein to have the atom bomb. Obviously, that's a disaster. But I don't hear any plan for how we're going to deal with Iraq if we do get rid of Saddam Hussein. And we need that plan. It has to be in place, and the American people have to understand what that is before we begin to talk about bombing Iraq, especially unilaterally. I think,
Governor,
we've got to make a case to the world that that's the right thing to do before we do it. I think this is all loose talk by the president. I think it's probably not smart.
Governor, I'm just going to ask you for a frank assessment of your prospects. We've got less than a minute in our conversation. 18 months from now, where do you think you're going to be?
I hope I'm contending, and I hope that I've got a coterie of followers, and particularly in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, and I hope we're in the middle of debates with the four or five of us that are going to be in the race.
Thank you very much. Governor Howard Dean of Vermont, who is a candidate for the Democratic nomination for president, and a man who speaks with articulacy and honesty, which is always refreshing in politicians. I want to thank all our callers, and I want to apologize to the ones we didn't get to. Jack Beatty, thank you very much for helping me along. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.